If we're talking about marketing advice, it's know your audience. Like, I know that I am marketing primarily to romance readers first. You know, I will like to expand eventually to other readers, fantasy in general. I do try to keep it more agnostic when I'm talking about my book and focus on the building politics and the medieval city builder, which is another thing that, like, there's not a lot of that. So that's a good selling point.
Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome everyone to another episode of Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P. here as always. Today I'm joined by author Melissa J. Cave. How are we doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
It is a Wednesday night, so I'm doing fine. It could be any other night, and I'd still probably say the same thing. But because it's a Wednesday today, we'll just say because it's today.
Yeah, we're through the worst of it.
Exactly. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you come from, kind of this big spiel, as it would be.
Yeah, so I am, well, right now, published author as of November 1st. I currently work for the Department of Defense, and I'm a military brat and veteran myself, so I am from everywhere. I've been moving for a good chunk of my life, most recently Virginia.
My wife is also a military brat and has fun stories of, like, Germany when she was a child. Can't give blood to this day because... So, now... One of the things we're kind of talking about in the pre-show, and I bring this up because it is something we don't think about a lot, is we tend to think of, you know, people from the military as being not the most abstract or creative of beings. And so when you tell people you're an author, in particular in the fantasy genre, and that you were a soldier, that seems weird now. Now, culturally, that's also ignoring the fact that, like, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and all those guys were soldiers at one point in time, too. But it's, I think, a little different culturally now than it was at that time.
Yeah, you get the image of discipline, and so that discipline kind of crushes creativity and individuality. But really, like, one of the most important components of creativity is experience, in my opinion. Like, see the most places, know the most people, experience the most weird and diverse possible life. And that will inform writing, especially, better than just about anything else.
Well, I mean, when we look at modern TV writing, it is clear that the people doing the modern TV writing have never left Los Angeles and don't know amazing people other than their dog.
Yeah, and that's the advice that I give to any young writer, is to go out and get a weird job. Like Louis L'Amour, the Western writer, is kind of an idol of mine, and he had the most bizarre collection of jobs you've ever seen, like going on tramp steamers around the world. And that will show up in your writing, even if you're not talking about tramp steamers. That experience will appear.
Well, if nothing else, it makes you a fascinating person to talk to, which is just inevitably going to lend to storytelling. My daughter's godfather, one of the things that, like, I always love talking about him is because he spent time as a cabbie when he was in his early 20s, and just listening to him tell stories of just that job alone. Like, he had plenty of other weird ones, but, like, the people that he met just driving a cab made for some of the most interesting listening in the world.
Oh, for sure.
So I can only imagine, like, you know, having, like, say, the, you know, having left the country, the get moving around element of, you know, being in the service, just giving you an endless amount of stories to tell there.
Yeah, that, and actually a lot of experience for storytelling, now that you say that, because anytime you get a group of military people together, they're going to start telling stories about the weird stuff that happened. And when you're actively in the military, you've got a lot of standing around time to tell stories. So that refinement of the storytelling experience is definitely there.
Let's hurry up and wait, as they say.
Exactly.
Interesting. Now, out of curiosity, does that background lend in any way specifically to the fantasy element of the writing?
So as a veteran and just sort of the military experience in general, like there's a lot of that in fantasy and in mine in particular. I write medieval or medieval-ish fantasy. So it's got knights, they just came out of a war. So a lot of their experience plays throughout the series. Like I try not to like make a character that has PTSD, like as their central character feature. All of them have a variety of ways of responding to what's happened to them. So that shows up, and there's a strong theme of what do you do after the war is over? And that's also kind of the central question that I ask about the series that my male character, Remen, is trying to answer is like, do the promises that we make during war ever survive the peace? And of course, just coming out of 20 years of war in the Middle East, like this is a relevant question to me, but this is one way that fantasy is aspirational because he does actually try to keep his promises. It takes a lot, but he does try to keep his promises to his surviving men.
So it sounds like you're approaching it from a hopeful angle, which is not something we see a lot in modern writing in general. It's a lot of, I don't say doom porn, but...
Yes. Yeah. And that was deliberate on my part. I'm tired of... And I think maybe that is also a younger person's game, the grim dark stuff, like because you don't have much experience with the actual grim, the actual dark, and so you like to get around and play with it a bit. But I think we've had enough of that. I think we've had enough of deconstructing heroes and everything is bleak and everyone is terrible and the bad guys win. And, you know, I'm tired of reading that. I'm tired of seeing it. And so it was a conscious decision on my part to show good people doing their best.
It's funny you mention that because for me in most of my life, I've been a horror guy. That's my thing. And I still enjoy reading it and whatnot. But it definitely doesn't do for me what it did, say, in like my late teens and early 20s. It doesn't carry the same like cachet, I guess. You know, I'm easily amused by reading like something that's actually got like a positive end of a story. And I think only because maybe because it's for so long, writing has been taken over by, you know, I guess maybe my 20s, I've been very happy that everybody dies at the end of a story because, oh, you know, it's maybe flipping the idea on its head, having come up in the classics. But now it's like everybody's writing the ending where everybody dies. So it's like there's nothing satisfying in that. I'd rather find like some glimmer of hope in my writing. You know, that certainly that's the stuff that I'd rather pass down to my child, say that much.
Well, and you get a lot of big, so I'll say I'm over 40 now. And so having gotten that much of a time scale, like the idea of old age is no longer as foreign to me now. And so you have your young, dramatic, violent, et cetera, years, but then you have to start thinking in a longer scale than that, like what happens beyond that and planning for a longer time frame. And I think that like the nihilist stuff, that's cool to a certain and popular demographic, but I think it's natural for adults to start to want more than that after a while, like just part of growing up.
I mean, at a certain point, you have to have a reason to keep going. And if you think it's all doom, then that gets pretty difficult to take on the next day. It's like, you know, why am I doing all this? If this is all it means, 20 years of that behind me, I don't need another 20 ahead of me. Interesting. Now, The kind of work you're doing right now, what is the book that you said you just put out in November? And this is your first book?
Yeah, so debut fantasy novel, Traitor's Son, first book of The Empire of the Stars. And actually, I wrote the entire series before I published book one. So I have 6 books done, which is 5 main stories and 1 side story, because I did not want to be another George R. R. Martin. And it's like, I'm not leaving this hanging. I'm going to have that much done.
Nobody does.
Well, and that's happened so many times.
Well, I have to ask the question, like, how do you manage that? Like, I'm a musician, and so like when I finish something and put the song together, like I just want people to hear it as soon as I possibly can. I can't imagine like waiting on an entire album just to put out a single song for people to hear, which is essentially what you're talking about doing. How do you manage to be okay with that inside? Do you have like a ton of people around you that you can at least get test reads out of?
So, well, I've got some. So that did help. but also it's a very tightly connected story. And so like having had that luxury to write all the way through book five and then go back to book one and edit it, because I know the characters better, I know the little things that I need to sprinkle in ahead of time, I am so glad that I did. Like, it's because it's a long, continuous story that builds to a particular conclusion. So it is much more tightly written now than it would have been if I published as I wrote.
Well, that's positive. How lengthy are the editions of this? It's not something like, you know, each book's 100 pages, or like, are we dealing with 400 page books?
So book one is the shortest book, and it was 150,000 words. Yeah, book five was the biggest, and I think it's at 297,000 words right now, that one could be split. I'm still on the fence about splitting that one in half, because I did have to use a different structure for that one than I did in the previous books, but it builds so nicely to the climax. So I'm thinking probably still be one book, just one very long book.
Is this book, obviously it's a big concept, taking up multiple volumes. Is this something that you like have been working on like since your teen years? It was an idea you always had and you just felt like you had to get out there? Or did you kind of have the idea, I'm going to be a writer, and then find the thing that you wanted to write about after the fact?
Yeah, so I've been a writer all of my life. Like, we got our first computer when I was 10 years old, and I've been typing stories ever since. So this particular idea came to me in 2019. And originally, it was just a short, simple romance. It was book one and done. But by the time I got to the end of book one, there was so much more to tell that, you know, I conceived the ending pretty quickly after I finished book one, like meaning the ending of the series. And so then it was just a matter of getting to that.
Okay. Now, you mentioned romance. So I have to ask the question, what is your intended audience with this book?
So I'm focusing on, and that's a good question if you want to talk marketing too, because I include romance because that's how families are made. And this is a family saga. Like, there will be children born, you know, et cetera. So romance is a huge component, particularly of book one, but it is not the only genre. It's also action, politics.
A friend of mine was actually mentioned the other day on Twitter, specifically mentioning romance in men and about how men are starved for romance in books, because they've all, whether you write romance now, it's not written for the way men experience romance. It's written specifically for a very particular type of woman. And, you know, R.H. Snow is the person I didn't mention who remarked about this. And I don't know if it was something that like I hadn't thought about or, but I mean, the romance is definitely like, you look at a lot of the classics, it's always part of the story. It's like, it's never not there. Even look at, you know, our Star Wars, you know.
So. Mm-hmm. No, you're saving the princess for romance. Like, that's the reason.
You know, it's not maybe quite the pulp element of it, but in the broader like storytelling school, like romance has always been a part of it. So do you it sounds like you're trying to approach from more of like a understanding that this is a natural part of life, and if you're going to tell a true story, something that feels honest, it kind of has to be there.
So, and obviously I can't speak on behalf of men, but I know enough men and have talked to them often enough to know that like romance is not an automatic reject for them. I think based on the feedback I've gotten from the men that have read the story, and I've had a surprising number that have read it and reviewed it, they need to care about the characters in order to care about the romance. And a lot of the romantic fiction that men are not reading is badly written men, unrealistically written men, sometimes cringe, often cringe, which is fair because men don't always write women well, you know your audience, blah, blah, blah. But if you want, romance is not an automatic reject for men. If they care about the characters, they'll stick around for the romance and they'll care about the romance. And so I'm aware in terms of marketing that book one is romance heavy and is going to be a harder sell for men, but I'm hopeful that they will be able to get into the book and the series. And I think men do want to read about having a family. and like that experience of life. I don't, you know, maybe your 20-year-old men aren't quite so open to it, but I think the vast majority of male readers are perfectly fine with the family and romance and stuff, as long as they care about the characters and the story is moving and there's, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that, like, obviously there's families and stuff that happen in this. I'm curious, like, scope-wise, and like, we'll say in the time frame, like, what kind of time frame are we looking at? We've got, like, a book that takes place over generations, or are we looking at something that's, you know, very, a very pointed place and time in this fictional world? It just, a lot of things happen in that time period.
Yeah, so it's a fairly compressed time period for present day, but there are some extensive flashbacks to previous generations. So one way of looking at it is that the catastrophe that created this world has already happened. You know, in terms of fantasy, often it's either to prevent a catastrophe or like the fallout from it. And so these are all the survivors of the catastrophe, and then learning why that happened will help them prevent it from happening again. And so in that way, you're looking at multiple generations of experience, and particularly my protagonist O'Fell's family, their history will weigh heavily in this. And then, so that's the first five books. And then I'm actually working on a trilogy to take my main characters through the rest of their life. So that's going to be a much longer time frame.
So kind of moving along, actually talk about the marketing stuff. What are, you mentioned a few things in like your onboarding paper that I make everybody fill out. If you want to be a guest on the show, everybody, you can go on my website and I'll have you sign out and fill out the forms too. I'm sure it's annoying to people because it's a lot of questions. Everybody's like, I just want to sign up and show up and be done with this. Why do you make me do all this homework? Come on. But you mentioned a few different services, and in one of my most recent episodes, we talked particularly about scammers, and especially like when it comes to marketing. Out myself here, say I'm not a scammer, but I also, you know, don't generally work with the kind of people I'm often talking to because they just can't afford what I'm capable of doing, and I wouldn't want to do that to them. But you get a lot of people trying to sell high-end services to people that frankly just aren't in a place for it. So you mentioned two things. One of them was NetGalley, and the other one was, what was the other website? Book Sirens. And anytime like I talk to, it almost feels like they keep prices at maybe a point where it's like not so exhausted that people won't buy in, but it never seems to deliver on the promise that what these type of websites have. So if you could go in and tell me a little bit about your experiences with both of these, I think it would be awesome for my audience.
So it was a great experience with both and learned some things in both cases. So Book Sirens is much cheaper. It's $2 per download. So if you have 12 people download your book, that's $24 out of your pocket. That is very reasonable. And you don't pay until the people actually do it. They invoice you afterward. I did not get nearly as big a response there as I did from NetGalley, but I think Book Sirens is more indie friendly in general. So, you know, they're more targeted toward that audience and less toward the huge industrial bestsellers that you find on NetGalley. NetGalley is the site of the industry that, in terms of serving up advanced reader copies for reviewers, for booksellers, for librarians, that's where everybody in the publishing industry goes to put their books out and then let the booksellers read it, decide if they want to carry it in the library or you know, in the bookstore or in the library or wherever, and then reviewers as well. So that one is much more expensive. If you were going to get an account by yourself, it would be like $500. And I don't remember if that's once or like once a year or once period, but either way, that's a lot of money. So I used a co-op for that, and it was $55 a month, which, you know, if you're going to put an arc out, usually it's only for a month or two. So that was a much more reasonable price for me. The good thing about NetGalley, aside from a humongous audience of professional people, is that you get a lot more information out of it. So for example, they can give you thumbs up or thumbs down on your cover, which gives you a good feedback on, you know, the response that your cover is getting. They give you reasons why they requested a arc. So like, was it your description? Was it your cover? Was it this? Was it that? And so, for example, I got 72 thumbs up and no thumbs down on my cover. which tells me I did a good job with my, well, I didn't, my book company, you know, my cover designer did a great job. But that's great feedback. And if I'd gotten a bunch of thumbs down on it, then that would have been a good reason for me to go back and say, okay, what's wrong with it? So that was really great. And then also in both cases, a lot of those reviewers will go over to Goodreads and or Amazon and post reviews ahead of time, which gets still more buzz going, because if they've got followers, particularly if they are bloggers, which a lot of them were, then if they got followers on Goodreads, then those people are going to be anticipating your book on Goodreads. So it's a great way to get enthusiasm going before your book ever comes out.
Interesting. I would ask a question. Who is going to click on the book and not be interested in the cover? I thought this was interesting enough to click, but I hate the cover. Well, then why'd you click it? Like something's not adding up in your metrics there. You're lying to yourself about something, boss.
Yeah, well, I mean, they could be clicking it to tell you this is a terrible cover, which is also useful feedback.
And that would be useful feedback, I guess. I guess they wouldn't be requesting it if it was a terrible cover, I would imagine. But I don't know. I guess I don't know the way that the website works. Anytime you can get more detail and like get very specific details out of an audience, so that's awesome. So it sounds like that place is actually set up to give you more granular data.
Yeah, for sure. You can get reports after the fact with very specific details about who downloaded it, who didn't download it. So you can see like they requested it. You get the choice whether or not to give it to them, because you can see like what they've scored previous books. So if there's somebody that likes to just randomly two-star everything, you don't have to give them the book. And then you're also building interest if you're writing a series or, you know, just as an author, you want to build an audience. Then they will be interested, hopefully, in your follow-up books. So if they read and review, then you know that you can contact them and say, hey, here's book two. Are you interested?
Okay. What other elements do you think are paramount in going out and starting doing this for your first go-round? I'm imagining you have an email list set up to collect your own names. How does that incorporate with both of these types of services?
So one doesn't necessarily touch the other. I did get a bunch of people sign up for my mailing list before my book ever came out, which is just good to know that there's people that are serious fans, you know. So, but it's all part of sort of generally tested methods that work. So I have a website, I have a mailing list on it, I have subscribers only goodies that I put out there. So for example, the first chapter of book two is available on my website to subscribers, as well as art. So, you know, all of it feeds into each other. And then also making sure that inside the book itself, at the end of the book, it's got the, please review me, this is my website, sign up for my mailing list, all those typical target points linking to those various areas.
And what is your primary way of driving traffic to your email list?
So the end of the book. That would be my best. That, and I keep a strong presence on X. Yeah,
but that's where I was gonna go. Obviously, yeah, not particularly the what's the term there? The loss leader or the. It's been a long day. Did I mention that
today? No, I know.
But yeah, no. Specifically, like you said, X. You on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, all the places, or is X primarily where you work from?
X and Instagram. And that is another thing. So, you know, if we're talking about marketing advice, it's know your audience. Like, I know that I am marketing primarily to romance readers first. You know, I will like to expand eventually to other readers, fantasy in general. X, I do try to keep it more agnostic when I'm talking about my book and focus on the building politics and the medieval city builder, which is another thing that, like, there's not a lot of that. So that's a good selling point. Whereas on Instagram, I focus more on the romance because that's where mostly romance readers are.
Yeah. Or TikTok. There's, you start getting into book talk, that's just a whole weird group of people.
Yeah. Well, and that's also a question of what reader or, you know, what audience do you not want? There's a lot of crossover between Instagram and book talk. And of course, the crazies always get the most attention. Most are just romance fans. But you don't want to get a particular fan with very strong expectations that you're not going to be able to satisfy, because then they will not hesitate to give you bad reviews.
How important, or inevitably, a bad review is going to happen. So how do you treat those within like your marketing? Do you ignore them outright? Do you go the look at this idiot and, you know, do you monetize the haters with it? Do you have an approach?
So the first few hurt because it's different when, like, I've been in writing groups for 20 years. So I'm used to that level of critique, and writers are very careful and generally very careful and refined about how they address each other's books. They give you a compliment sandwich. So the first few bad reviews hurt, but you get enough reviews, and unfortunately I've gotten enough that don't make sense, then you can just shrug them off altogether. Because I've gotten some that say, like, that the first book looks like it was cut in half for length, and then I got another review that said that they didn't see why there needed to be the rest of the series because everything was satisfied in book one. Well, both of these cannot be true. So, you know, I'm appreciative of the feedback, and I try to take aboard the stuff that makes sense, but I've gotten enough that doesn't make sense, and not everybody's going to respond the same. Not everybody reads it the same way. And so just kind of have to accept that and let it roll off.
And now, I always ask this question because one of the reasons you find people going the self-publishing route is because they find, I guess, we'll say the market of the, it's the mainstream market is not interested in certain ideas. Do you feel like your ideas pushed you to self-publish versus trying to do all the querying and all of the finding the agent and all that? Or it just, you know, you have the faith in yourself that you can do better than what those people are going to do, and you'd rather take it yourself?
It's both. One is my heroine is not a girl boss and never will be. She starts off very timid, and it takes a long time for her to come into her own strength and understanding, you know, her, when I say strength, I mean like her strengths in particular. She's never going to compete with my male lead in, you know, she's never going to pick up a weapon. She's got her own particular areas that she's good at. And I find that way more interesting than yet another 100-pound twig swinging around a sword.
So she did kill an ice girl in under 5 seconds.
No, there is none. I am so sick of that. That is so boring. It is so unrealistic. And if you can pardon the rant for a second, like, as a woman, that doesn't reflect my experience or my interests. Like, and as a veteran, like, I am fully aware of what I'm physically capable of, and I have to be smarter than that. And I find that much more interesting than pretending like I can go toe-to-toe with a 6-foot man, because I know I can't.
I mean, in general, if you talk to people on the internet, I remember I was once told that I married my wife so that I could control the life of a black woman.
Oh, I would like to hear her response to that.
Well, I mean, more than anything, I'm like, the amount of agency that takes away from my wife as a person, like, oh, you must think she's the single dumbest human being on the earth to marry someone that would just marry her to own her. Like, I can't imagine anything more demeaning to her as a person. So I think one of us has a problem, and it ain't me.
Yeah, well, and that's my response to girl bosses, honestly, because it's such a anti-woman way to look at the world, to only value masculine strength. And like, for most of, especially when you're writing a more historical fantasy, like, you know, the realities of biology in that time, there's a reason why women didn't go far from the house. There were many reasons why women didn't go far from the house. Some hygienic, some practical, just, you know, the odds of being picked up and never seen again were much higher in those days. So it's, one, interesting as a matter of a different world than ours, but also, like, women did successfully navigate that world for centuries. And imagining the ways that they did that and the strengths and values that they brought to that world is much more interesting to me. And in a medieval city builder, which mine is, like, the war's over, they won new lands, they're building a city in it. And so they're having to develop society in tandem with that. So starting from the beginning with that, and then men have particular roles and women have particular roles. And it's not because the men are keeping the women down, it's because the women are very good at what they do. And showing that value is interesting.
it's always been interesting to me to, I mean, from my perspective, it's like women have controlled the entire thrust of human history. Like, their choices in mating literally decide what the future is going to be. And I mean, I guess this, you know, creating the entire future is maybe not as glamorous as being able to swing an axe, but it's just frustrating.
Yeah. And I've spent, in the course of writing the story, I've had a lot of reason to sort of think this through in terms of like the complementary roles that men and women play in society. And women have always been the softer, unrecorded hand. So when you take the concept of law and politics, for example, this is public, it is recorded, it is known in history. But what you don't see is like, say, you know, you've got a criminal in the neighborhood. Women were the ones, like historically, they would have started small and local and exchanged gossip and shame in order to try to get little 10-year-old Johnny to stop shoplifting in the neighborhood. They were the soft, unofficial hand of trying to prevent crime. And so then when Johnny graduates to robbing stores, then the hard hand of the law, which is usually masculine, gets involved. But those were two spheres of society. Like, you had the society side that women were in charge of, that was unofficial, that was just a matter of binding the community together, tending the community, exchanging information, saying who was trusted, who was not. This stuff does not get written down, but it still bound the community together. And it was a crucial role that we're no longer filling.
Wow. Well, I mean, honestly, that is a crazy long conversation that I would love to have with you sometime.
We veered off a bit. And yet there is not a long lecture on the subject in my book. It is very much show, don't tell. But that idea is in there.
Well, I'm glad you're tackling concepts. One of the things that, like, I've said about the quote unquote Iron Age is that this is a time for people to say that they want to say all the crap that's been diluted for centuries because of the mainstream business of publishing, gatekeeping, and watering everything down. Like, I don't really care what anyone's politics are. I'd rather see them as they envision them, as opposed to through the lens of what a big multinational corporation thinks they're trying to say or thinks is going to be more palatable. I kind of like the unfiltered, raw, you know, idea behind something personally.
Yeah, well, and just being allowed to have different ideas. Like, there's a certain approved set of ideas, which I do think, to go back to the earlier question, like the fact that there is a certain character, female character, that is allowed and is not allowed was a factor in why I chose to self-publish. And then the other reason was just simple return on investment. Like, I don't, if I have to do my own marketing either way, then I don't see what traditional publication really brings to the table anymore.
I mean, most of the people I know who do traditional publishing, they still end up having to do almost all of their own marketing anyways. So to me, anytime I hear anyone taking this, I'm like, I think you guys dodged the bullet.
Yeah. Well, and as a fantasy writer, like, I've had a few writer friends that have gotten an agent, gotten published, started their series, and then, of course, no marketing support. And they thought that once they got a, you know, agent and publisher, then they were golden. They didn't have to do anything else. They just had to let it roll out onto Amazon and it would do its thing. And the fact is, no, those series withered on the vine. And so not only are they not making money off those series, they're no longer allowed to write that world because the publisher gets three bad books and then they say, all right, we're done. You know, you got anything else? They're not going to nurture you through. And so those authors have to wait, either buy back the copyright or wait however long it is, 7 years, 10 years before they can write in that world again. So they lost their whole world. And no, I'm not willing to take that risk.
Awesome. Well, where can I send people so they can check out you and your book?
So melissajcave.com.
Beautiful. You know how many authors I have difficulty knowing, just send people to your name? Give them a whole spiel. Oh, http://// No, just your name.com, folks.
Try to make it easy.
But to me, that's the whole point, is making it as easy to get the book in people's hands as possible. So thank you so much for coming on today, Melissa. I thought it was a fantastic conversation. Definitely with some stuff that I don't know that we've ever really talked about on this show. I got into some specifics that I know my audience will definitely appreciate. So, you know, like I said, thank you.
Yeah, not a problem. Great talking to you.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you. But maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironagemarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.